Welcome to Random But Memorable, a podcast from 1Password. I'm Sarah, one of the founders at 1Password.
I'm Rue, head of password manager development.
I'm Matt Davey, 1Password's chief experience officer.
I'm Anna, the producer behind the show.
And we're the hosts behind Random But Memorable. Together, we offer up bi-weekly security advice, interview special guests from the cybersecurity community, and round up the latest in security news with Watchtower Weekly. We may even play a silly security game or two. So sit back and enjoy the show.
I have made myself the worst sandwich. I had an early breakfast today, and then I got hungry, and it's now 3 o'clock here. And I made myself a curry powder mayonnaise and and mango chutney and chicken sandwich.
Oh my god.
Which if you pre-mix it, right, is coronation chicken. It's very good. Right, it's a national favourite of England, but because I was in a hurry, I basically just put all the ingredients in a sandwich, and let me tell you, it does not taste as good as it does when it's mixed.
Good Lord, that sounds not okay.
There is no way that is something that someone. No, I need to get Anna on it. There's no way that is like an official like.
No. It's one of the most popular sandwiches in England.
Curry something with mayonnaise, with marmalade, with chutney. What?
Like, No.
I like that you threw marmalade in there.
I mean, that sounds awful.
Oh, that sounds awful.
It's curry powder, mango chutney, mayonnaise, chicken, sometimes a few raisins sprinkled in there too. I'm not making this up.
The good news is I'm not going to want a bite, so you're fine. Keep that sandwich all to yourself.
Apparently, it's supposed to have parsley, thyme, bay leaf, cumin, turmeric, ginger, peppercorns, mixed with cream and mayonnaise and dried apricots. I don't make it like that.
What?
I do the speedy version.
Yeah. How'd that work out?
Take a piece of chicken and throw it through the garden. Grab every herb and spice you can. Slap some mayo on that bad boy and call her done.
It was created in 1953 to celebrate Queen Elizabeth II's coronation.
I bet you $20 she never tried that for love nor money.
That is probably true. I didn't quite have long enough to toast the bread either, so it's that middle bit in between toast and bread where it's just basically floppy hot bread. There we go. So should we get into the fact that this very content won us an award?
Yeah. Well, no. Okay.
Listen, much like the sandwich, there was an honorable mention, but there is...
Look, I think apparently we get a certificate.
I'll use my other Webby as a paperweight to hold down that certificate. It'll be great.
I do still have mine over the fireplace, I must say.
Yeah.
I have mine.
Yeah.
I'd like another one so they'd like bookends.
That's right.
I love the fact that we won an award and we're talking about a completely different award. So I guess we're skipping over the entire section of us being grateful for this Webby Award and instead diving straight into some Watchtower Weekly.
Oh, sorry. No, we can take a minute to be grateful about being an honorary award mentioner.
What I will say is Anna put a lot of work into the application. So congrats, Anna, for this achievement.
Yes. Yes. Really, like, this is Anna's award, not ours, because
yes.
Anna's the one who takes just the gristle that enters into the top of the hopper and turns it into something lovely out the other end.
Yeah, our listeners won't even know anything about coronation chicken now. Like, it'll all come out in the wash.
Yep. So congratulations, Anna. We love you.
Just as an update, the sandwich is not getting better with each bite, so... There we go.
Oh, you're still eating it. Great.
Of course I'm
the
still
hot floppy bit with the mouthful of curry. I can't see why it wouldn't.
Warm floppy bread.
The curry powder to mayonnaise balance is just a little bit off, you see. Yeah, that was my downfall. Yeah, that bit there. I feel like you need to properly mix it, stir it in a bowl.
Mix it in a bowl.
Yeah.
And then slap it on your hot floppy bread.
We should make sure that hot floppy bread is the title of this episode, by the way.
I really have not set myself up for success with this episode.
No. Should we maybe jump into some Watchtower Weekly before things get worse?
Let's do that. So, this is named after 1Password's Watchtower feature, but This is part of the episode where we like to run down some of the latest security news, updates, or share our reactions to them. So, to kick things off today, we have a story from The Verge, which is, we're one step closer to a global cybersecurity standard for smart home devices.
Ooh.
So, as useful as connected devices like doorbells and smart lights are, that was weird. Mine just turned on.
What?
It heard you talking about it.
Yes, Master. How can I help?
Ding dong.
That's weird. Okay. I'm going to sit here and be freaked out the entire rest of the episode. Okay.
Is it a toothbrush?
We have been very vocal about the fact that it is still wise to exercise caution when using connected tech devices in your home, especially after years of reading about security camera hacks, toothbrush botnets, and smart stoves turning themselves on. But until now, there hasn't been an easy way to access a product's security credentials, but a new program from the Connectivity Standards Alliance wants to fix that. Just announced in the last couple of weeks, the CSA's IoT device, just that's Security Standards Alliance, Internet of Things, Device Security Specification. I can see why they use acronyms. This program aims to provide a single globally recognized security certification for consumer IoT devices. So device makers who adhere to the specification and go through the certification process can carry the CSA's new product security verified PSV mark. If that security camera or smart light bulb that you're buying carries the mark, you'll know it has met the requirements that help secure it from malicious hacking attempts and other intrusions that could impact your privacy. And also stop it being, you know, part of a botnet and that type of thing. So, the standard. Eugene Leiderman, who is the Director of Mobile Security Strategy at Google, said, "Research continually shows that consumers rate security as an important device purchase driver, but they don't know what to look for from a security perspective to make an informed purchase decision. Programs like this will give consumers a simple, easily identifiable indicator to look for." Leiderman is also part of the CSA working group that defined the 1.0 spec for the program. This has been developed by over 200 member companies of the CSA. These include, along with Google, Amazon, Comcast, Signify, Philips Hue, and several chipset makers as well, Arm, Infineon, NXP. According to Tobin Richardson, of the CEO of the CSA, how does he introduce himself? Jesus. Products carrying the PSV mark could start to appear as soon as this holiday shopping season. The CSA's announcement on March 18th follows news last week that the FCC has approved implementing its new cybersecurity labeling program for consumer IoT devices in the US. Both programs are voluntary, and the CSA's label doesn't compete with the US Cyber Trust mark. Instead, it goes a step further, taking all of the US requirements and adding in baselines from similar programs in Singapore and Europe. The end result is a single specification and a single certification program that can work across multiple countries. So to get the PSV mark, devices must comply with the IoT Device Security Specification 1.0 and go through a certification program that includes answering a questionnaire and providing accompanying evidence to an authorized test laboratory. The voluntary program applies to most connected smart home devices, including light bulbs, switches, thermostats, and security cameras, and can be applied retroactively to products in the market. Along with the PSV mark, a printed URL, hyperlink, or QR code on the mark gives consumers access to more information about the device's security features. That is from the CSA in a press release. I think this is a great move. I also like the fact that this kind of CSA thing just takes the US trust mark and kind of makes it worldwide by leveling off the baselines. You know, if you're building a product, aiming at that and you get the kind of US one included for free almost, it's a great thing.
Mm.
I do think it's going to take about 10 years for anybody to recognize this and what it means.
I think it's cool, though.
Yeah, I like the idea. I'm stuck on the CSA thing, though, because, like, for us here in Canada, that's what we require on anything electrical. Like, one more acronym that's the same letters. Like, how am I going to make sure it's all the same?
Oh, interesting.
And then at the same time, I can't read what wattage is on my light bulb anymore because I'm of a certain age now. So I'm hoping that these things are not, like, every device is going to have so many QR codes on it. I'm not going to know what I'm supposed to scan anymore. Like me and my camera holding it, you know, like zoomed in. What does it say? Is it safe? Is it safe? Plug it in, Ma. It's fine.
But I think this is like, this is what the problem is with most trust marks, is that no one really knows what they are.
I do like, though, that it is, like you were saying, that it's global. Like, we went to all of the places and we found what the bar was, and we just set the bar the same for everyone as opposed to just picking the lowest bar. Hopefully that we get a better adoption for that then, because especially given the number of companies they have in there, you know, you'd think they'd all be like, okay, yep, we invested in it. Let's go. Just like the next story. Let's go, Matt. Let's go.
Let's go.
So... hackers have found a way to open any of 3 million hotel keycard locks in seconds. And this is reported by Wired. So, another contender for security blank, because what else could hackers have opened 3 million of in seconds? Car doors, crypto accounts, casino slot machines, suggestions on a postcard, welcome. But it's well known that the security researchers descend on Las Vegas every August for what's known to become as Hacker Summer Camp. The back-to-back Black Hat and DEF CON hacker conferences, so it's a given that some of them will experiment with hacking the infrastructure of Vegas itself. But at one private event in 2022, a select group of researchers were actually invited to hack a Vegas room hotel to find its digital vulnerabilities. In every one of the room's gadgets, from its TV to its bedside voice-over IP phone, one team of hackers spent those days focused on the lock of the room's door, perhaps its most sensitive piece of technology of all. Now, more than a year and a half later, they're finally bringing to light the results of that work, a technique that they discovered that would allow an intruder to open millions of the hotel rooms worldwide in seconds with just two taps. So let's take a moment to picture someone breaking in and walking into your hotel room. That's horrible. Okay, moment over. A team of security researchers are revealing a hotel room key hacking technique that they call unsafe lock. Why not just leave the E in there and just call it unsafe lock? Unsafe lock. 0 out of 10 for naming there. The technique is a collection of security vulnerabilities that would allow a hacker to almost instantly open several models of the SAF lock. Ah, that would be the reason why. Of the SAF lock brand. RFID-based keycards are the locks sold by Swiss door maker Door Macabre. The Swiss door maker is called Door Maker. Door Macabre.
It's great.
Honestly.
10 out of 10.
The safe lock systems are installed on 3 million doors worldwide in 131 countries. By exploiting weaknesses in both Door Macabre's encryption and the underlying RFID system that they use, the researchers have demonstrated just how easily they can take the keycard lock, their techniques that starts with obtaining any keycard from a hotel room by booking a room there, grabbing a keycard out of the box or one of the used ones, reading a certain code from that device with a $300 RFID read-write device, and finally writing two keycards of their own when they merely tap those two cards onto the lock. The first rewrites a certain piece of the lock's data, and the second opens it. So one of the researchers said, two quick taps and we open the door, and that works on every door in the hotel. The researchers shared the full technical details of their hacking technique in 2022, and the maker, Door Macabre, says that it's been working since early last year to make hotels that use the safe lock aware of their security flaws and help them fix or replace the vulnerable locks. But it may take months or years to reach some hotels. So you may be asking how they were able to get, you know, the front desk software. They nicely asked a few people, a researcher said. Manufacturers assume that no one will sell their equipment on eBay and that no one will make copies of their software, and those assumptions are not really valid. So what they've done is they've asked for the production software and someone's just given it to them, and then they've reverse engineered it. Once they'd managed all that reverse engineering work, the final version of their attack could be pulled off with little more than a $300 RFID read-write device and a couple of blank RFID cards. Or an Android phone or a Flipper Zero radio hacking tool. The Flipper Zero is actually really cool. I very much enjoy mine, but there's no way that I will take it across borders. So I think anytime I stay in a hotel, it will be absolutely fine. Because it's the last thing you want in your bag if it does happen to be searched or go through security.
What does it look like?
It looks like an orange 80s TV remote control, and essentially you can read and write radio signals.
I think it's rather bold of you to assume that anyone's going to open your bag and like be searching it and be like, oh, that's a Flipper Zero. This guy's a hacker. They're going to be like, this is a wild remote control.
Oh, no, they have a list of items that they're looking for, and that is one of them. Like, the computer literally picks it
oh,
up
really?
on the X-ray machine.
On the scanner?
Yeah.
Oh, neat. Okay. Look at me learning things.
I think it's because you can essentially, like, do all sorts of things with it. I don't do any of that stuff with it, I should add. But you can do.
Flipper Zero is a portable multi-tool for pen testers and geeks in a toy-like body. It loves hacking digital stuff such as radio protocols, access control systems, hardware, and more. It's fully open source and customizable, so you can extend it in whatever way you like. This is neat. Why do you own this?
Because I went to a security conference and they were handing them out.
Oh, okay. That's perfect. That makes perfect sense.
Okay.
Excellent.
Now we know.
Thank you.
Yeah.
So they said they think the vulnerability has been there for a long time, and it's unlikely that they were the first to get there. So that's terrifying. There's so much CCTV around hotels and stuff now. I think this is a problem, but I don't think it's a huge problem.
I think there's lots of other ways to get into hotel rooms that is not this. So, I mean, like, not great, but also this strikes me as that there's probably some good low-hanging fruit elsewhere that you can do to help secure hotel room doors.
Yeah, I was in a hotel the other day, and the housekeeping was in my room and had left the door open. And I just walked in and picked up my laptop and walked out. And I felt a bit iffy about that.
That it is why I actually always keep the do not disturb sign on. And I'm like, no, I don't need, no thanks. No need to clean my room. We're all set. I keep it plenty tidy for the 3 days I'm
here. Yeah, that's true. All right, moving on from hotel doors to glass doors. Users say Glassdoor added real names to their user profiles without their consent.
This is not good.
This is not good.
This is not good.
No, not good.
Hopefully they didn't do it to the section where it has everybody's salary. So, users say Glassdoor added real names to user profiles without their consent. In recent weeks, users of a popular site, Glassdoor, which lets anyone anonymously sign up to review companies that they've worked for, say Glassdoor collected their name and added it to their user profile without their consent. One user who goes by the name Monica, oh hang on, have we just added her name to it? wrote in her blog post that Glassdoor added her name and her city where she lives to her Glassdoor profile following an email exchange with Glassdoor customer support, despite having never provided her name during the sign-up process some years earlier. Monica accused Glassdoor of getting her full name from the email that she sent to customer support, which she says that they then added her to her Glassdoor profile. Monica repeatedly protested Glassdoor, telling customer service that the company did not have her consent or permission to do this, but Glassdoor said Monica was required to have her name added to her profile, adding that this would not compromise her anonymity of past reviews that she gave. Monica said that her anonymity might not last if Glassdoor was to experience a hack or a data breach and compromise users' data. As Monica explained, Glassdoor will add a user's real name and their potential other information to the user's account without their permission if Glassdoor learns it. And the only other option is to delete your account. This story has been widely shared on social media and news sharing sites, with many fearing that their anonymity could be compromised by having data collected about them and added to their digital profiles as well. An attorney with the digital rights group Electronic Frontier Foundation said that Glassdoor has been an industry leader in defending its users' anonymity. They said previously they had defended an anonymous Glassdoor user in court who tried to unmask their identity. The attorney said, "We hope that Glassdoor will continue to defend its users' anonymity in court, but the latest news regarding Glassdoor's policies raises concerns about whether users may be identified even if their information is never sought by an employer or law enforcement. Those policies appear to conflict with, or at least be in tension with, Glassdoor's goal of encouraging employees to candidly review their employers." Yeah, this is kind of wild. Like, if their database literally says this person, this review, this real name. God, if that did, like, you know, there's a honeypot there waiting to happen.
That's the blackmailers. That's the, you know, like that's, you know, the emails that you get where it's like, I was on your computer and I saw what you did. Send me money or I'm going to send it to everyone. Like that's the, listen, this is your legit job profile. We know that you hate your employer and we're more than happy to share this review with them unless you give us some money. Like,
I'm fine. My review of you is glowing, Sarah.
I, you know what? And it could, maybe it's just me. I don't trust the internet to be anonymous ever.
No.
If I were going to do something like this where it's anonymous, I would be setting up a fake profile, fake email. If I had to contact fake support, it'd be like, hi, I'm Jane Doe. Here's my email, janedoe@gmail.com. Help me out. I wouldn't be like, my Glassdoor name is this, but my Facebook name is this and my OnlyFans is that. Like no, like you just like, why are you giving everyone information? Like just, if you're trying to be anonymous, like it's you're not very anonymous if you're telling everyone who you are.
Oh my gosh. Okay, enough talk about doors, whether hotel, glass, or otherwise, because it's time to introduce our guest this week. I recently had a chance to sit down with Stephen Balcom. Stephen is the CEO and founder of the Family Online Safety Institute, which is a nonprofit with a very important mission to help keep kids and families secure online. Stephen's been in the biz for a long time, so he was an absolute treasure trove of helpful tips and information on how we can keep our digital lives safe for us, our kids, and our families. We touched on some really interesting ideas around striking that co-piloting balance right, so we're not invading our kids' privacy, but encouraging open and safe dialogue and communication with them. It's a really valuable listen, I think. So let's go ahead and drop it in here. I'm delighted to be sitting down today with Stephen Balcom. Stephen is a policy advocate and the founder and CEO of the Family Online Safety Institute. FOSI is a nonprofit with a mission to make the online world safer for kids and their families. FOSI convenes the top thinkers and practitioners in government, industry, and the nonprofit sectors to collaborate, innovate, and create a culture of responsibility in the online world. Stephen, I can't wait to get into family security with you today and hear all of your top tips on how we can keep our loved ones secure. It's wonderful to have you here. How are you?
I'm doing well. Thank you so much for having me. Really appreciate it.
Yeah. So let's kick it off. Can you talk a little bit more about how and why you founded the Family Online Safety Institute and your motivations there?
Sure. I was running another nonprofit called ICRA, the Internet Content Rating Association, that I set up in 1999 to rate websites. And it was a pretty good solution for what I guess you could call Web 1.0 world, where websites were relatively small and not very dynamic. But around 2005, 2006, this new thing called Web 2.0 started to emerge. And that was social media, MySpace, and then Facebook and Twitter and so on. And it was the world of user-generated content that, of course, we all now live in. And married to that was the emergence of these smartphones that allowed everyone, including kids, to access the web wherever they were and to upload whatever they happened to be doing to the web. And so in that kind of a world, kids were creating the content we used to try to keep them away from, if you know what I mean. And we tried to bring some smart people around the table to figure out how on earth are we going to do this. And sitting around the table included people like Verizon Wireless and Sprint and AT&T, some of the mobile carriers who up until that point had never considered themselves to be part of this Web 2.0 world and realized that indeed they were now. So in 2007, we launched it and we began with 7 corporate members and had our first annual conference at the end of that year. And fast forward to today, we have 34 members and the whole range of technology companies that you could imagine in membership.
That's incredible. That's a wonderful amount of growth since the beginning. What is the mission statement for FOSI?
Very simply, to make the online world safer for kids and their families. We don't say the word safe because there's no such thing as 100% safe, but we can definitely make it safer. And we do it through what we call the 3 P's of policy, practices, and parenting. So enlightened public policy is what we try to persuade our friends on Capitol Hill, in the state capitals, in London, in Brussels, etc. Public policy, laws, regulations that are based and grounded in research and not in banner headlines from the Daily Mail or something like that. So to that end, we work with policymakers on both sides of the aisle. We're nonpartisan and do our best to encourage the emergence of good legislation. We also talk to the regulators. So we sit down with the FTC a great deal, Ofcom in the UK, Julian Mangrant in Australia, the e-safety commissioner. So these are the folks who actually have to enforce the laws as they are created. And so we work with them and provide a kind of a conduit to the tech companies and vice versa, so that there's better understanding of the work that they're doing. Now, the second P is industry best practices. And what we mean by that is we work with our members to up their trust and safety game, if you will, and act under NDA as constructive critics of their products and services. And to that end, we have worked with a number of the brand name companies to try and get them to put more resources behind the safety of their products. And lastly, the third P is an initiative we call Good Digital Parenting. So this is where we take everything we've learned from the laws and regulations, add that to the products and services that the tech companies are providing, including filtering tools, security devices, and so on, and translate that into easy-to-use language for parents. We have something called the 7 steps to good digital parenting. You can put that on the door of your fridge to remind you to keep talking with your kids, to set ground rules, and to be a good digital role model yourself. So that's kind of us in a nutshell.
It almost sounds like you are like a conduit or a mediator between the tech companies and the governments. Does that sound right to you?
Yeah, I mean, we're a convener. That's our big role. We bring folks together, and not just tech and government, but also the academics and the researchers and the psychologists and the educators in this space. We do a lot of work, too, in our own research, talking to parents and teens about their own attitudes and behaviors, hopes and fears. And it's in that convening that we think the real work happens.
Yeah. Yeah. I can imagine that leaves you with a really impactful feeling if you've been able to reach right out and interact with people on a very human level in that way. How has it evolved over the years? And how has it had to adapt to the changing online landscape? And very specifically, like, what do you see as the most pressing challenges or emerging threats to children's online safety today?
Great question. You know, it's funny because when we got started, we only had two P's, the policy side and the industry best practices side. Within a few years, we could see that there was a real need to help parents, and we call it to empower parents to confidently navigate the web with their kids. You know, all of the issues that people have become familiar with, cyberbullying, sexting, overuse, oversharing, screen time. That's been a really vexed question over the last decade or so. And I would say over the last year or two, the emergence of Gen AI or generative AI through ChatGPT and the many other products that are out there has just exploded onto the scene and caused, as it were, a new wave of issues and concerns and fear, as well as excitement. And, you know, it's why we decided to do a year-long research project on it last year.
Yeah, tell me more about that. What have the findings been? What did you set out to discover? What was the focus of the project?
So we wanted to, and by the way, it was a 3-country look. We looked at the parents and teens in the US, Germany, and Japan to find out their experience of Gen AI, their concerns, their biggest fears, their biggest hopes, and just generally their attitudes towards it. Surprisingly, it was the first time we did research on a topic where the kids admitted that their parents knew more about Gen AI than they did. Every time we've looked at anything from social media, the use of Snap or the use of Instagram, and in the early days, the use of Facebook, teens were far ahead of their parents in terms of usage, knowledge. But with Gen AI, we found something really interesting. And I think it's because a lot of parents are also employed, and many were already using ChatGPT and others for their work. And of course, not surprisingly, they were quite concerned about Gen AI taking over their jobs. So they really got in deep. In terms of what parents were concerned about for their own kids was that they would not develop critical thinking skills in the way that they had to going through school and college and into the workforce, that their kids would just get their essays written for them, if you know what I'm saying. When we asked teens about their biggest concerns, ironically, given that they're not in the workforce yet, their biggest concern was whether there will be jobs for them when they do get into the workforce.
Wow, fascinating.
That plus the use of Gen AI tools to create images and videos to cyberbully. That was not a concern of parents, but it was definitely one of teens. That's a huge concern if you're still at school.
Indeed, but I was surprised that it's not a concern for the parents. That was my surprise in that finding.
It didn't come up because I don't think they had experienced it yet, whereas the teens were experiencing it.
Wow. Yeah. So FOSI aims to create this culture of responsibility in the online world. Like, what role do you see individuals, tech companies, and policymakers playing in fostering that safer digital environment for children?
Yeah, if you can envisage a large circle, and I guess at the top of the circle would be government. I mean, government has definitely a role to play in setting the rules for what is allowed and not allowed online. Now, it's a complicated role, particularly in the United States, where we have the First Amendment. We have this tricky balance between privacy, rights of privacy, and safety on the other side. So it's not easy legislating in this space, but government has a role to play in providing both a legal framework, but also to urge folks to do more and better in this space. I would definitely say law enforcement is also part of this picture and part of the circle. For the really heinous stuff, we need well-resourced law enforcement to go after the bad actors. And in many cases, law enforcement does not have the resources it needs. But even so, it's part of the picture. Industry. It's not acceptable for industry just to put out tools and products and services without thinking about online safety. And so they definitely have a role to play. And part of what funds the industry are venture capitalists. When I go and talk to VCs, I say, you know, it's great if you have a gifted CEO and maybe a fabulously skilled CTO, but who's your chief online safety officer for this new company? Let's make sure that you bake that in. So safety by design, if you will, into the new company. And then, you know, parents, teachers, even the kids themselves have a responsibility for maintaining safety online. Parents, for obvious reasons, particularly for the younger kids, and we encourage them, of course, to use parental controls. Although when kids hit high school level, the emphasis kind of shifts to being more of a co-pilot with your teen and working with them so that they utilize the online safety tools that have been created for them and young people to report, to block, to be private, and in many ways just to kind of shape or to administer their online lives. And then teachers, of course, have a huge role to play in terms of giving online safety advice or lessons and modeling how to be not just safe, but civil online as well.
Yeah, so there's a lot of different, everyone has a part to play here. There seems to be like a real interplay between parental rights and children's rights at the moment. Can you talk about that a little bit more?
Yeah, I should have said right at the front that FOSI is an international nonprofit. And what I often notice in Europe is there's a far greater emphasis on children's rights and teens' rights to access content, to gather online, to express themselves, but also a right to be safe when they're online. Here in the US, we tend to emphasize parental rights, and that often has sort of pretty heavy connotations with it, and particularly in certain states. I know in Utah, we did an event in Salt Lake City a few months ago where they're enshrining parental rights into legislation, and that it basically says parents have the right to determine where their kids go online, who they interact with, etc. And for us, it's not either or, it's both and more. So yes, parents, particularly of younger children, absolutely have the right and the responsibility to keep their young kids safe online and use parental controls. But things shift in the teen years, and kids at some point or another start to have rights themselves, including rights of privacy and a right not to be surveilled while they're online by their parents, particularly if they're in a family where one or both of the parents are abusive, or if the kid is, you know, 15-year-old is questioning his or her sexuality or their religion or anything else that a parent might vehemently object to. I mean, are we saying that kids until they're 18 have zero rights and that at 18 inherit 100% rights? Or is there a gradual curve upwards? And not surprisingly, we argue that kids have rights as they age, and it's a gradual curve. It's not an easy thing. It's not a one you can point to and say, absolutely, this is the point at which they have X, Y, and Z rights. But it is a commonsensical one, and also a realization that 15, 16, 17-year-olds will have the ability to circumvent whatever you try and put in their way.
Yeah, it's a struggle that my wife and I certainly deal with on a day-to-day basis with a young teenager in the house, of wanting to make sure that she is not inadvertently exposed to things that she shouldn't be exposed to, while also giving her the freedom to stretch and learn new things and try new things and stuff like that. And that balancing act between giving her enough space, giving her enough privacy to make some of the honestly dumb mistakes that we did when we were young, while also trying to be sensitive to the fact that the landscape is so different than it was when we were young. There's so much more that she could see now that we didn't even know existed in many cases. So it's a really difficult thing to do. And I think that you're right. Like, it's the real challenge is that at a certain point, it doesn't matter what we do. Circumventions will be put in place. I mean, it's my daughter is currently, we had to administer a little bit of a consequence for a couple of weeks and take her phone away from her. Well, she figured out that very quickly she can just use the smart speaker in her room to text her friends and call her friends. So it's like, all right, great. Like, I'm so glad that you don't have screens, but there's a lot of holes in this sieve, as it were.
Yeah, yeah. No, I mean, when my younger daughter was a teenager, I joked that she majored in Facebook at high school. But, you know, we had to take her phone away. And, of course, a friend at school the next day gave her an iPod Touch. And I kind of suspected something was going on because I could see her light on at 2 in the morning. Oh. So we started to take the router to bed, only to discover that she had hacked into the next door neighbor's router. She babysat for them. So, of course, you give the babysitter the Wi-Fi code.
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah. So, mind you, she's grown up to be a pretty adept social media marketer. So these are transferable skills.
Yes. And also, like, even looking back on the dumb things that we did when we were young, we turned out fine. So there's, you know, there's always sort of like that hope that sits in the back of my brain as we're going through all of this, of just like, yep, this will pass. Things will be okay. It's hard to navigate. It truly is.
It really is tough, and it's getting harder. Even for folks like us who are in the biz, you can just imagine what it must be like for folks who aren't familiar with technology and feel quite uncomfortable about it. That's the real struggle.
Yeah. So how does FOSI approach educating parents on online safety? And, like, what are the key principles or tips that you have for parents?
Well, the 7 steps we developed to try and condense all of our various different messaging advice, and it boils down to, not surprisingly, number 1 is talk with your kids. And that talk should be done early and often. And when I say early, I mean as young as kindergartners. They can understand the word bad. They can understand the word danger. They can understand concepts like, we're not going to let you have this whenever you want it. There will be times when you can have it and other times where you can't. We'll also set up some rules where there'll be consequences if you misbehave. So laying all that out early is absolutely critical, so that the kid knows that when you act, you're not doing it unfairly. It's based on stuff you've already talked about. But it's a conversation. It's not like the birds and the bees, you know, one and done. This is one you're going to have to do almost on a yearly basis. Back to school is the time that we often suggest is a good time. Look, you're now going into third grade. We're getting you this gizmo watch so that you can contact us and we can contact you. But no, you're not getting a phone. You know, those sorts of conversations. Also, things like milestones, like you're turning 13. You're now legally able to go on to various social media sites. But, you know, maybe we're not going to. We want to discuss each one in turn. And, you know, at 14, 15, sitting down with them before they go back to school. Now, show me how you report something on Snap. Tell me how you are remaining private on Instagram. This co-pilot concept of working with your kid to make sure that they are utilizing the tools that are there for them rather than you trying to lock everything down. So that's number one, talk with your kids. Number three, from memory, was use parental controls. We talked about that before. Oh, number seven, I guess, probably the most important, be a good digital role model yourself. The number one complaint I get from kids when I work in schools is I can't get my parents' attention. Mom's always on Facebook. Dad's always just checking his email. Put your own screens down and give your kids FaceTime. And whether that's, you know, we talk about tech-free zones in the house. A tech-free zone includes the bedroom. We're not fans of screens in kids' bedrooms. No screens at the table if you sit at the table for a meal. Tech-free time zones. So maybe you have a 9 o'clock or a 10 o'clock curfew where everyone puts their devices in a closet to charge up overnight. We say to parents, you know, PTA meetings, raise your hands if you use your phone as an alarm clock. And almost invariably, everyone's hands go up. And the next thing I say is, don't. Don't use your phone as an alarm clock because it's the last thing you're going to look at when you're going to bed. It's the first thing you're going to look at. And sometimes even before brushing your teeth, you'll be checking your email and your texts and the weather. And if you have little kids, they love to jump on your bed in the morning. They'll see that blue haze on your face and they're going to want the same thing. Kids will do what you do rather than what you tell them to do.
Oh, it is something that I am so hyper aware of. That one in particular, like that hits hard because I do have my phone on my bedside. I do use it as an alarm clock. It is the first thing I look at in the morning. And at times my son will come in to say hi in the morning and stuff. And I, as quickly and surreptitiously as possible, will set the phone aside and, you know, welcome him into the room and say good morning and everything else. But nonetheless, like, I'm not setting a good example there. That's for sure.
Yeah. I mean, it's a really, really hard one because the phone has become so entangled in everything that we do. I went out the other day and I had my wallet on me, but I didn't have my phone. And I just thought for a second, would I go back if it was the other way around? If I had my phone, but not my wallet, I realized that I could get by with my phone because I've got Apple Pay and I've got all sorts of stuff. So my phone has become more important than my wallet.
Yeah. Yep. And that trend will only continue as things like digital government IDs become more commonplace and things like that. Okay. I want to touch back on the balancing act between safety and privacy. Are there specific tools or strategies that you recommend there for parents as they're navigating this?
The top parenting experts reiterate over and over that the number one job of a parent is to manage their own emotions. In other words, not to freak out if a child says something about what they found on their phone, or not to be tempted to stalk their kids online. We came across a father in Baltimore who had cloned his 17-year-old daughter's phone so that every keystroke that she made came through on his phone without her knowledge.
Oh.
Right? And when we asked him about it, he said, well, it's for her safety. To which I said, well, what if you discovered something untoward that you would have to talk to her about? And he said, well, I'd challenge her. And then I'd say, well, she would obviously then ask, how on earth did you know that? And as soon as it was revealed that he was stalking her, you know, all trust would then be broken. And whatever he had to say she would not hear. So there has to be a balance. We have to contain our fears while realizing that at times we don't necessarily invade our children's privacy, but we're going to say, look, we'll set it up so that there's an understanding that from time to time, mom or dad are going to look at your phone, look at your social media. You know, when my daughter begged for Facebook at age 11, I said, no, not until you're 13. She said, everybody in my class is on Facebook. I said, well, you aren't, so not everybody is.
Yes.
But I said, you can go on Facebook, but I'm your first friend. So you need to friend me first. And I promised that my wife and I would not comment or stalk her, but just know from time to time, we'll have a look and see what's going on. Same with the phone, same with kids with gaming systems and so on. So it's this delicate balancing act. Now, of course, again, as the child gets older, they will find other ways to remain private and keep things from their parents. But if you can keep that dialogue going, if you can keep that openness, then they're far more likely to report stuff to you. And particularly if you don't lose your mind over something that they're reporting to you.
Yeah. Making that a safe environment. We've always told our daughter, like, we will never get angry at you for telling us the truth. There may be consequences for the behavior that you're telling us about, but we will never be angry about it. I think that there's a parallel here as well. Do you think that the teenagers are often neglected in the conversation around online security and almost seen as something to be managed instead of someone to be included?
Oh, for sure. Most certainly. And that's why we, whenever we can, we include teens in our surveys and our research. It's extremely important to hear from them because it's their lived experience that will inform public policy, but it will also inform the products and services that tech companies build.
Yeah. Yeah, for sure. Okay. Just a few more questions. This has been wonderful, by the way. I've really enjoyed this. Do you see any promising trends to help aid family and children's security, or do we have a long way to go?
We definitely have a long way to go because the technology is changing at such a rate. And I've been at this since the 90s. I've never seen an acceleration quite like we're experiencing at the moment. The hope, the glimmer of hope, is that, as it were, this next generation of parents who are having kids now, have grown up with the web. I mean, the web happened to me halfway through my life, and we had to really try and get up to speed as fast as we possibly could, not having had a childhood or an early adulthood that involved apps and websites and social media and so on. So young parents of kids, very young kids now, at least have a basis. They know the lingo. They know how to get around a computer screen and a phone and a gaming system. That gives me hope that there will be more technological knowledge or at least less fear around the technology than was the case with, say, boomer parents.
Yeah, for sure. The generation of children coming up now, turning into adults, like, they've never lived without it. And it will be really interesting to see how it shapes their adulthood, which is very different from us, where there was the before times and then there was the after times, right? And having to learn how to navigate it in the moment as we were older. It'll be a really interesting sort of like historical study one day, I think.
And because of that, I think that parents, A, will freak out less. The parents will always freak out. Let's face it. I freaked out. We do.
Yes.
There'll just be less fear around the technology itself, number one. And number two, I think that the younger parents have built up some resilience around dealing with the worst of the web and the harms that they've experienced. And through that resilience and through that experience, we'll be able to pass on lessons learned in a way that previous generations of parents have not been able to. I know how to fall out of a tree. I know how to navigate with a paper map on a bike. But these are skills that this generation of kids will never have to. Unless the GPS system fails, I don't see us ever having to teach kids how to navigate with a paper map again, which seems a pity, but it's a reality. But What I'm saying is there's a built-in of experience of having to deal with hardships online and knowing that there are ways to overcome it and build resilience. And those are really precious nuggets of experience to pass on to the next generation.
Yeah. Yeah. I like that. I like that a lot. All right, Stephen, this has been absolutely wonderful. Where can people go to find out more about you, the Family Online Safety Institute, and the incredible work that you're doing?
Well, our website is fosi.org, so F-O-S-I.org. We're also on LinkedIn, we're on X, we're on Instagram, all the usual places. And YouTube, we have a whole YouTube channel, youtube.com/fosi, F-O-S-I. And you will find a number of quite amusing videos with actual parents and kids illustrating the seven steps. So that is something worth having a look at.
Oh, I like that a lot. I think we're going to be queuing that up in the Faye household here. That's going to be good. All right, Stephen, thank you so much. This was wonderful.
Well, thanks so much for having me.
Okay, looks like I'm up next.
You are. Oh, we're doing a giveaway.
We're doing a giveaway. And, you know, that was a great listen. Thank you to Stephen and Rue for that. And so as we've talked about that, and as we're raising ideas around the importance of family online safety this week, we wanted to continue to spread this awareness with a giveaway. So we're giving folks a chance to win one free year for their 1Password family account. All we'd like you to do is to write to us with your stories or tips on how you like to stay secure as a family, or even neat little tricks on how you use your 1Password family account already. Maybe you've introduced 1Password to your kids in a clever way, or you've managed to make password managers stick with them so they're using it consistently. Whatever it is, we want to hear from you. All you need to do is write into the show on Twitter or via email. You can tag us on social at 1Password and use the hashtag #randombutmemorable, or you can email us at podcast@1Password.com. Any tips or stories we read on the podcast will win one free year for their 1Password family account. You can remain anonymous in name. Please just state this with your entry. This giveaway is now open and closes on April 17th, 2024. You can see all the terms and conditions in the show notes.
Oh.
Yay.
All right. With that, I think we can close up our show with some security blank. So let's hit it with that jingle. Oh, snap.
It's going.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, I didn't realize how much I needed this today.
Love it.
Oh, it ends a bit early, doesn't it?
Woo!
Yeah! Oh, man. Woo! All right. Okay. All right. If you are tuning in for the first time, the rules of the game are very straightforward. I will read out some recent security news headlines with one or multiple words blanked out, and Sarah and Matt will have to guess which words are missing from the headline. I'm going to give multiple choice answers, but they're welcome to shout out guesses, either joking or legitimate, at any time. So this week, our first security blank headline is from Wired. March of 2024, they ran an article titled, "Some of the most popular websites share your data with over 1,500 companies, third-party advertisers, AI training models, secondhand fashion retailers, or your mom."
your mom.
I'm so glad we added your mom in there.
I love that.
Oh, dear.
What do you think?
All right. I'm going for the win this week, and it's going to be AI training models, because the 1,500 companies, third party, like all of that is obvious. Like if it's only 1,500 companies, I'd kind of be surprised. And those companies are third party advertisers. So I got to go with AI training models.
All right, Matthew.
I'm going to go with A.
A.
I think it's definitely over 1,500 companies. That sounds like a good clickbaity headline.
All right. In March of 2024, Wired ran an article titled, "Some of the Most Popular Websites Share Your Data with Over 1,500 Companies."
Come on.
Yeah.
It seems so low, doesn't it?
That seems obvious, too. That seems like a 1999 article.
I know.
Look at Matt putting a friggin' star on the keeping track there. That's
oh, jeez. Sarah, I would have gone with AI training models, okay? I think you were right. In fact, if I could, I would just rewrite the right answer.
I mean, they're probably doing that as well. Let's be honest.
Are those 1,500 companies all AI training companies?
Yeah, they could be. Yeah. All right, let's move over to the BBC from March of this year. Is TikTok really a privacy nightmare, a danger to the West, a blessing in disguise, a mass surveillance machine, or a brain-rotting scroll fest?
This is hard.
Is TikTok really a privacy nightmare? Is not a question that anybody's really struggling with. I feel like because it's made in China, that the hype around it is the fact that is it a danger to the West?
See, I was thinking that, but it's a BBC article, right?
This is from the BBC.
Well, I'm going to go with B then, because danger to the West, because it's not a danger to us here in the, I shouldn't say us as in because I'm not in the UK, but as a UK person, if I'm on the BBC website, it's not a danger to me. I'm going to keep scrolling my TikTok because the brain rotting scroll fest, but it's going to be danger to everyone, not us. So I'm going to go with danger to the West.
Yeah, I'm going to follow you.
All right. In March of 2024, the BBC ran an article titled, "Is TikTok Really a Danger to the West?"
Ooh. Yay!
Well done. Good job. Good job. All right. All right, let's jump back over to Wired, also from March 2024. Here come the blank. Is it new NFTs? Here come the spam bots? AI worms? AI girlfriends, or deep fake celebrity shampoo ads?
These are all horrible. What even is a worm?
I feel like Anna's putting the silly one at the end, and so we know the silly one. I want the silly one to be integrated into the rest of the answers.
That one seems like the best one.
Here come the AI girlfriends. Why not? It's March 2024. I feel like you can have an AI girlfriend in March 2024.
Bring on the AI girlfriends. Sure.
I don't think she'll be very interesting.
I'm going to go with spam bots just because is AI worm a thing? Like, what is that? Is that a thing? Or is that just a silly one and it's the shampoo ads is the right one?
So you are.
Nobody knows. No. Okay. There's no worms. this isn't a thing. Worms is not a thing. Okay, good. I'm going to go with spam bots, but
spam,
I don't.
All right. You're locking in spam bots. Matt, you're locked in on AI girlfriends.
Sadly.
Okay. In March of 2024, Wired ran an article titled, "Here Come the AI Worms." Yes, AI worms. We now have to go and find that article and figure out what the heck an AI worm is.
It's when the AI eats something that isn't quite right.
I'm thinking about dogs that have worms. You got to deworm that puppy. Just deworm that LLM.
Got to deworm the AI. Oof. Ugh. All right. In March of 2024, Bitdefender ran an article titled "Blank Blank Blank: Pokemon Passwords Reset After Attack." Is it Security Snorlax, Password Managers I Choose You, Gotta Hack 'Em All, Red versus Blue? Oh gosh, Anna gave me a. I gotta insert my own Pokemon pun here. Good Lord, I wasn't prepared. Hold on.
Do you do the Pokemons? Do you know the Pokemons?
I don't. I can't even remember Pikachu's name. There it is.
Pikachu's name.
no, I got nothing. So, yeah.
No Ash Ketchum getting you?
No, yep, no. no Ash Ketchum here for me. Sorry.
I only know that the song is an absolute tune.
It's a banger. It's a bop.
There's a song?
Pokemon. Yeah, it's great.
Oh, that song. Okay, I know that. Okay. I haven't heard of this, and as someone who plays Pokemon Go, I will say, I'm feeling worried now. I can't afford my... I'm trying to get to level 50. I'm going to get there someday. It's not happening. I would accept hacks if I could get some bonus XP, but I'm going to get out the Master Ball, and I'm going to use a raspberry on this one, and I'm going to try to catch the right answer. I'm going with all the puns, and I'm going to go with Gotta Hack 'Em All.
All right.
Yeah, I think I'm going with Gotta Hack 'Em All. It's the only one I understand.
All right. In March of 2024, Bitdefender ran an article titled, "Gotta Hack 'Em All, Pokemon Passwords Reset After Attack." Excellent. Well done, Sarah. Okay. Great one. All right. Our last one here from The Register in March of 2024. The majority of Americans now use blank. Is it ChatGPT for work or school, pet names as passwords, two-factor authentication, ad blockers, or Siri to dictate their day?
Oof. Okay. I'm going to work through this one. So it's not ChatGPT because it's not the majority of Americans. Pet names as passwords. I feel like in March 2024, that isn't a headline. Two-factor authentication. Come on, that's a joke. Majority of Americans. So that leaves ad blockers or Siri to dictate their day. Majority of Americans, I don't think, have an iPhone. Like, majority. I don't know. Maybe they do. I'm going to go D, ad blockers.
See, and that's the... I feel bad because I want to do something to not have the tie. I want to make sure I win, but I also, I believe, to be ad blockers because I want to say ChatGPT, but I don't think the majority of Americans are using it yet. So I think it's got to be ad blockers, which I'm disappointed in because it means I have the same answer as Matt.
I know. So, all right.
Wow.
Locking in ad blockers then. Let's find out. In March of 2024, the Register ran an article titled "The Majority of Americans Now Use Ad Blockers." That's correct. You both got it right. Congratulations.
Yay.
Boom, boom.
But overall, congratulations to Matt, our winner today. Great job, Matt.
Thanks very much. I'm 8 minutes late for a meeting. So.
Oh my gosh, it's late. Oh wow, we went way over. All right. Well, yeah. That does it for today's episode. Love you. Love you both.
Rue didn't realize he was late. Now he's like, oh, gotta go.
Love you. Bye.
Love you both. Bye.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.